Hi, I'm Paul Ingalls. Around Thanksgiving, 1968, I was 12 and among the millions who ran out to buy an extraordinary new collection of songs from the Beatles. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. Since Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in June of 1967, there hadn't been a full album of new Beatles material. Magical Mystery Tour and Yellow Submarine both mixed a few new tunes with previously released singles and B-sides, but now a double album of 30 new songs in an era when double albums weren't often done. In contrast to the psychedelic covers of their previous three albums, this album jacket was all white, the words "The Beatles" embossed in an angle and small print on the cover. The music inside was frankly bizarre to me, but a stimulating mix. I remember feeling after a first listen in the wood-paneled basement of my family's home in suburban Maryland that this wasn't an album that we could play on the family stereo upstairs, because a lot of it seemed, well, either naughty or tortured or just edgy.
Why don't we do it in the road?
I used to listen with my best friend Johnny Sedwitz. Johnny Sedwitz is not here with me today, but I am here with other friends. And we're going to hang out and listen to the White Album again and remember with you what it was like to hear it for the first time.
My name is Travis Parkin. I was 19 years old in 1968.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. I was 13 in 1968.
I'm Scott McNichol.
I take two.
I was just turning 15 when the White Album came out, and I was living here in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
I'm Lucio Urbano. And I was 14 in 1968. I grew up in West Texas.
I was rooming with some college students from the University of Michigan near the campus, and I was listening to it in a guest room they had upstairs.
I suspect I didn't listen to the whole album until a couple years later, probably in Bill Barrington's basement.
Number nine, number nine, number nine, number nine.
And my distinct memory is the very first listen with about 8 to 10 of us. We sat quietly for our teenagers on a Sunday afternoon and listened to all four sides straight through.
I was a migrant worker in those days, so we couldn't afford stereos and we couldn't afford LPs, but we heard about it. And radio at that time was being adventurous, so we got to hear some Beatles music that we could not hear on regular radio.
We also have a panel of musicians, both here and across the country, to help tune our ears to the musicianship of the Beatles.
Hi, my name's John Sperney. I'm a musician and composer in New York City. I was 3 years old when the White Album came out, so the first time I actually heard it was in 1978, when I was 13, and I heard it at my family's beach house in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. I thought it was just about the weirdest album I had ever heard.
My name is Christy Krueger. I'm a singer-songwriter from Dallas, Texas. I was not born in 1968. I first listened to the White Album in 1996. When I was 19 years old, I had taken a Beatles course at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and I thought it was the most amazing piece of music I had ever heard.
This is Douglas Grant, a musician and recording engineer and producer in Tucson, Arizona. I lived in the UK in 1967 and 68 and had just returned to Vermont. So I almost certainly heard it on the console furniture stereo in the living room, which wasn't too exceptional because my mother used to buy us the Beatle records as they came out. This one certainly was not likely to please her musical ear nearly as much as previous ones had.
The eagle picks my eye, the worm he licks my bone. Feels so suicidal, just like Dylan, Mr. Jones.
My name is David Gans. I'm in Oakland, California. My parents were liberals, and so they didn't mind us playing that weird stuff on the cheap stereo in the living room. I think I was in the 10th grade when a White Album came out. And less than a year later, I started playing the guitar, and the two songbooks that I used to teach myself chords and stuff were the CSN songbook and the White Album songbook.
So I sing the song of love, Julia.
I'm Rob Martinez, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I play in a 50s rock band called the Daddy-O's. In 1968, I was 5 years old. It would be 10 years before I would actually get into the album. 1978, my high school buddy Andrew Allfelder and I would learn these songs in our high school band while everyone else was learning Van Halen and AC/DC. We were knocking out Happiness is a Warm Gun.
But don't you know that happiness is a warm gun?
We're going to give a close listen to the White Album, and to help us understand where these tunes came from, we have on the line from London our friend Steve Turner, author of the book A Hard Day's Right, the stories behind all the Beatles songs. And Steve, we're going to start by tracking cuts 1 and 2 on side 1, Back in the USSR and Dear Prudence. What can you tell us about these two?
Well, Back in the USSR was mainly a Paul song. I mean, the whole thing about the White Album is a huge percentage of the songs were actually written when they were in India. I mean, it was really the last time that all four Beatles were together and had leisure time, you know, had time to sit around and play songs to each other in a relaxed environment. And Mike Love of the Beach Boys was there, as was Donovan. And Mike Love said to Paul, wouldn't it be great to do a song about the Soviet Union in the style of Chuck Berry's Back in the USA.
Oh well, I feel so good today. We just touched ground on an international runway. Jet propelled back home from overseas to the USA. New York, Los Angeles, oh how I yearn for you.
You know, Paul started this song that was a kind of a pastiche of Beach Boys and Chuck Berry, extolling the virtues of the Soviet Union rather than the USA. You know, that was the whole joke of it.
Back in the US, back in the US, back in the USSR. Well, the Ukraine girls really knocked me out. They'll leave the West behind.
And of course, when it came out, there were some people that were already suspicious of the Beatles and their you know, possible leftward leaning, who thought this was terrible that they would sing a song in praise of the USSR. They didn't get the joke at all.
It's also indicative of some of the problems the Beatles were having at the time. I think Paul's playing lead guitar. I think he's playing drums because Ringo wasn't in the studio at the time. I think he was angry or something.
I heard that there was this sort of sense of competition between the Beatles and the Beach Boys, that each was like, you know, trying to top the other, or worried that the other guy was doing better work or something, you know. And I mean, what an amazing thing if Brian Wilson and the Beatles were spurring each other on to greater heights, you know. So in a way, it feels like this song is both a brilliant parody of American rock and roll and also a nice sort of salute to the Beach Boys.
You know, on the bridge, those high, you know, the fact that the idea was suggested by Mike Love, it makes total sense when you listen to it.
And Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence was also written at the Meditation Academy and was written about Mia Farrow's sister, whose name was Prudence. And she'd gone into the meditation almost like too heavily at first, you know, done too much meditation and had gone into almost sort of a trance-like state and was staying in her bungalow longer than she really should. And John wrote this song that basically said, hey, come out, you know, enjoy life. And so it was a very personal song addressed to her.
Well, Dear Prudence is probably my favorite song on the White Album, and it features this really beautiful finger-picking guitar by Lennon. And my understanding is that when they were in India, Donovan actually taught Lennon, you know, some rudimentary finger-picking patterns, which are basically playing the guitar with your individual fingers rather than using a pick.
Christy?
When I listen to Dear Prudence, I really feel like that song, in terms of production, does everything that a good book should. It starts out with this very sparse instrumentation, mostly guitar, with just, you know, you get a little hint of bass, you get a little hint, I think, of maybe the bass drum. I guess it's Paul playing drums. I think it's absolutely genius how he lays out, and then when he comes in, it's just bass, bass, snare, bass, bass, snare. And then at the end of the song, it's like he lets loose like a lion who's just been out of his cage. And I really love the growth that song has from beginning to end. I really feel like there's a climax and a denouement, and the song sort of fades out.
The bass line has this beautiful counter melody, with sort of glisses on the bass, like he's sort of sliding between the notes rather than playing the notes individually. So there's this great like doom 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 boom doom doom boom boom doom.
Paul, I also wanted to say something else about Dear Prudence, which was that I felt like it was a beautiful example of how the Beatles use their background vocals to sort of provide a film score for the lyrics that are presented to you. That the first introduction of the background vocals is at the word sky. They're holding the notes for a really long time, and it sort of feels like an opening in the sky. And then when he says look around, and you hear the background vocals going round, 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 it makes like sort of a circular, sonically provides you a circular motion.
Well, that's one of the hallmarks of latter-day Beatles stuff, is how amazingly they use their voices as orchestration.
Yeah.
You guys are doing great. I'm going to jump in because we've got 28 to go. Okay.
The sun is up, the sky is blue.
Dear Prudence and Back in the USSR. You're tuned in to the White Album Listening Party. I'm Paul Ingalls with our many guests re-experiencing the Beatles' White Album, released in 1968. Next on side one, Glass Onion, and then Ubladi Ublada. To London and Steve Turner. What about these two, Steve?
Well, Glass Onion, part of what prompted it was a letter that John was sent by a pupil at his old school in Liverpool. I think it was part of an English lesson or something. He'd written and said, you know, could you tell us how you write your songs and what the meanings are? Actually, this guy, it turned out a few years ago, I found out his name's Stephen Bailey, and he's a sort of a design guru in England now. Anyway, he wrote this letter to John, and John, he wrote quite a nice letter back saying, well, people attach all these sort of meanings to songs that I never intended in the first place. And then he thought he'd write a song that actually was, you know, a complete trail of red herrings, basically, just sort of images that would lead people into speculation. And he'd kind of either made them at randomly, or some of them had origins in real places or incidents, like the cast iron shore is a beach on the River Mersey in Liverpool, and the bent back tulips. Derek Taylor told me that there was a restaurant in Knightsbridge called Parks, and the owner had tulips on each table, and he used to actually bend the petals back, and so that image came from that. But they're basically kind of grabbed out of the air to confuse people. And Obladi Oblada, that's a Paul song again. He certainly started that in Rishikesh in India, but it was based on a phrase that a guy called Jimmy Scott, who was a conga player from Nigeria, he'd been using this phrase quite a lot. He'd shout out Obladi, and the crowd would shout back Oblada, and then he would say life goes on. And he actually had a band called the Obladi Oblada Band, and Paul loved the phrase and kind of built a song around it and gave it a kind of a Jamaican reggae ska beat. And actually Jimmy Scott got in touch with him after it came out and demanded money, and there was some sort of financial resolution was made at some point.
David Gans, what do you like about Glass Onion?
Oh, Glass Onion. God, it has the same kind of feeling of sort of an overture quality that the beginning of Sgt. Pepper had. You know, it's self-referential in that funny way. And the other thing that I love about it is the string glisses. The way the orchestration, there's this kind of rubbery string section. And when I listen to this and the rest of this album, I think this was where Jeff Lynne got the idea for the Electric Light Orchestra.
John?
Just for me, you know, the first time I heard Glass Onion as a kid, like not as a musician, but the whole sort of self-referential lyric thing, that, you know, the whole idea of writing a song that's ultimately about songs that you've written before, to me was kind of a mind-blowing thing. Like to listen to a song and basically you kind of have to be in the club, you know, you have to know the songs that have come before it to appreciate the references that are made. You know, and there are even sort of sly musical references, like after he mentions The Fool on the Hill, you know, there's a recorder playing a sort of version of the line that the recorders play on the actual record, The Fool on the Hill. So just that whole kind of self-referentiality, I think, was a pretty new thing. And when I was a kid, it really struck me.
It was sort of an acknowledgement of their legacy for the first time, I thought. Ubladi Ublada, John Spurney?
The two things I love the most in the record are, if you read about the recording of the record, they had been through literally hundreds of takes. And there's a previous version that I think is on the anthology that you can hear that's arranged very differently and kind of revolves around acoustic guitar.
Desmond has a barrel in the marketplace. Marley is the singer in a band.
When they got into the arrangement that wound up on the White Album, you know, Lennon was playing the piano, and the sort of introduction that dun 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 dun. If you listen to it, it's played really, really hard on the piano, and supposedly that's because, you know, Lennon was just so angry that they were doing the 150th take, you know, and on the master tape there's like an expletive basically before he started playing because he was so sick of playing it over and over, you know. But to me, the thing I love in the song is the saxophone chart that George Martin wrote, and there's just this beautiful counterpoint melody that the saxophones play.
I'm glad you brought up George Martin's horn charts there, because there are a number of different places on this album where he just makes an incredible contribution.
One more thing before you drop Obla Di Obla Da.
All right.
The maracas. God, the maracas. The one of the coolest things about Beatle records is how spare the percussion is and how amazing their grooves are without huge numbers of drums and cymbals in use.
I told you about strawberry peels. You know the place where nothing is real. Well, here's another place you can go. The war is a mean man. You know that where is closest can be.
Ubladi, Ublada, and then Glass Onion before that. Scott McNichol.
It almost seems like this is a troupe of actors, mimes, and musicians all. It's just, this thing comes out in this almost childlike romper room, if you will, ditty. I just feel these people, I see them with colorful makeup on and dancing around as they sing this song.
I liked this song for a while, but I stopped liking it after about 10 years or so, and I can hardly stand to listen to it anymore. Suzanne?
Where's I Want to Hold Your Hand? It's like, what happened to the Beatles? I wasn't into the musicality of the album because I was such a young kid, but it was just scary, like Glass Onion. It was too much to try to figure out where they were coming from, and I just wanted the old Beatles back.
For me, Glass Onion was really a confrontational song, that John was kind of confronting his fans and listeners with their rumors, and to me it showed what a conscious guy he was, because how many people would make a song about their songs and about their relationships with their fans?
Lou?
Glass Onions in those days in the 60s in West Texas, we weren't aware of. But Ubladi, Ublada right away brings a big old smile to me, because, you know, we worked in the fields, and in those days, a hoe was a garden tool that we cut weeds with, you know. But we danced with those hoes. We played guitars with those hoes. Ubladi, Ublada, and I just keep on remembering, you know, working those fields. And as Americans, we were American, Mexican-Americans. It was Ubladi, Ublada with those hoes and dancing with them, playing the guitar. And it's just, that was the American side of us, you know.
Yeah, I could see how that would be a Whistle While You Work type song for sure. One of George Harrison's greatest, among those just ahead on our White Album listening party, so stay tuned.